Evergreen Sermons Online in Pastor Michael Gabbert's Wednesday night series on the book of Revelation. This message is from April 6, 2016.
I missed a week, and so it's been a couple of weeks. I'm meant for chapter 17 and 18 of Revelation to be together. They really go together, and we've had a little bit of a break, so I just want to review for a moment, and so we can pick up. You recall that chapter 17 and 18 are another sidebar. Chapter 16 took us through the bowl judgments. And there the bowl judgments are the final round of judgments or punishments that come as the wrath of God sort of is played out to its last drop. In chapter 17 and 18, we have, in a sense, the fleshing out of the result of that judgment, which is the fall of Babylon. Now, Babylon was predicted to fall all the way back in chapter 14. There was the prophecy of the fall of Babylon. And then in 17 and 18, we see the actual fall played out. In chapter 17, you recall that it was Babylon in the sense of a religious system in rebellion against God. And it was primarily the false prophet who is represented in chapter 17. Babylon is portrayed as a woman who rides on a scarlet beast. She is representative of the religious side of this world, this global system. And it is a picture of man's rebellion against God as played out in the religious parts of human nature. Now, at the end of chapter 17, we saw that the woman was destroyed, that picture of Babylon comes to a demise. But it says that the kings of the earth participated in her destruction. Now, that's important for us as we move into chapter 18, because in chapter 17, Babylon was primarily focused on this idolatry or in a sense, religious adultery, spiritual adultery. And this woman who represents, she's a prostitute or a whore. And it's this picture of man who is hardwired to worship, but rather than worship the one true God, man turns to whatever false thing he sets up as an idol for himself. Now, the woman represents that aspect of this global structure. But it's not the fullness of Babylon that's destroyed at the end of chapter 17, because what we see is, as she comes to her demise, the kings of the earth participate in that. In effect, celebrate her demise. The way to play this out, and what we'll see in chapter 18, is Babylon as a political and economic structure. Okay, we've got the religious element, we've got the political element, and the economic element. The religious element is really the means by which the Antichrist comes to global power. In other words, he takes global political power. But part of the instrumentality for that process is this religious system that undergirds him and gives him a kind of moral credibility. And so the religion, in this country, we talk a lot about the proper relationship between church and state. Well, in the Babylon of the final days, there is a truly an unholy matrimony between church and state. And the religion is in its corrupted form as a rebellion to God. It is a means by which the Antichrist takes power with the imprimatur or the credibility that comes from the church's approval. We can see this on a lesser scale with dictators, throughout history. The confessing church in Germany in the 1920s and 1930s was virtually forced underground because the state church became an instrument of virtually another branch of the government that gave Hitler, in his rise, sort of the stamp of approval that he was Christian. Karl Marx famously said that religion is to be considered an opiate for the people. That is, communists have always treated religion as a means by which people could be pacified and kept in a non-revolutionary mindset. If the government can, in effect, co-opt the church and make it a branch of the state. Well, that happens in its fullest extent in the last days with this final empire that is called Babylon. Now, as the church helps the Antichrist rise to power, chapter 17 probably fits best in the timeline occurring in the first 3.5 years of the tribulation. At the halfway point of the tribulation, in the same way that chapter 17 describes the political structure turning on the religious structure and basically celebrating its demise, what we have is halfway through the tribulation, we have the Antichrist taking a position in the temple in Jerusalem where he defiles that holy space by declaring himself God and demanding that the whole world worship him. So what happens is the religious aspect of Babylon is utilized until power is consolidated. Probably around the midpoint of the tribulation, when the church is no longer necessary for the consolidation of power, the political forces turn on the church and basically destroy it. When we get to Revelation chapter 18, what we have is now I would say a religionless society, but it's not religionless. It is a society without an organized institutional religion, but the religious impulse that is natural to the way we're created is now focused on the worship of the Antichrist, not just as a global political leader, but now as God incarnate. So chapter 17 covers this religious Babylon until the decline of that element. Chapter 18 is really in the last half of the tribulation, right up to the very end of the 7 years, because the destruction of the political and economic aspects of Babylon are really the result of the final spilling out of the wrath of God, and it takes us right to the battle of Armageddon and the second coming of Jesus. So, if you have stayed with me and survived all of these chapters of judgment, the good news is we are almost there. So, let's go to Revelation chapter 18, and we'll pick this up. It's a continuation of what we saw in 17, in the sense that it takes the topic of Babylon and finishes the story. But based on what I've just told you about where it fits in the timeline, it's not a continuation of chapter 17 in the sense that it's all one thing. These are two separate chapters. They're probably two separate visions that John has, and whatever time separates them in the way John received them, they're meant to talk about a sequence of events that happened probably with the bulk of that second 3.5 year period of the tribulation between them. Okay? So, Revelation chapter 18, the fall of Babylon announced. Verse 1. John says, after this, meaning after what he has just described to us in chapter 17, after this, I saw another angel with great authority coming down from heaven, and the earth was illuminated by his splendor. He cried in a mighty voice, "It has fallen. Babylon the Great has fallen. She has become a dwelling for demons, a haunt for every unclean spirit, a haunt for every unclean bird, and a haunt for every unclean and despicable beast. For all the nations have drunk the wine of her sexual immorality, which brings wrath. The kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality with her, and the merchants of the earth have grown wealthy from her excessive luxury. Now, it's interesting, because he's going to give us, in this chapter, more than in the previous chapter, he's going to show us a contrast between the secular values of Babylon and the biblical values of the people of God. In fact, we're going to see a real interesting verse a little bit further down where the people of God are commanded to rejoice, to celebrate this destruction. We'll talk about that when we get there. But John starts by saying, after this I saw another angel with great authority coming down from heaven, and the earth was illuminated by his splendor. Now, this is not Jesus. The language tells us that it is another angel, meaning a different angel, but the language tells us it's an angel of the same type that we've seen before. But where the angel of chapter 17 was probably one of the angels with the bowls, this is apparently an angel of some significant standing, probably higher in rank than those angels that went before. He's like them in his angelicness, but this one is described as having great authority, and his very presence, it describes, the Bible word is glory. The Greek word is doxa. In Hebrew, it's Shekinah. And that is the description of really the glory of God, the tangible and visible illuminance that represents the presence of God. Now, this is not God. This is an angel. But it's that same kind of aspect. The earth is made light by his presence. Now, this is not Jesus. This is an angel. But the inference of this visible, tangible glory, do you remember in the Old Testament where Moses would go and meet with God, and when he would return, he would have to cover his face because being even in that proximity to the presence of God, his face would glow with a kind of accumulated glory, sort of a remnant of the presence of God in his life. The implication here is of an angel that has been so deep in the counsels of the one who sits on the throne that when he makes his appearance, there is a remnant of the glory of God that is now associated with this angel who has great authority. It is a remarkable scene that John is beginning to describe for us here. Now, this angel comes and he makes an announcement. And it's a dual announcement. He says, it has fallen. Babylon the Great has fallen. The use of that word twice to emphasize the fallenness, in Greek, it's a literary styling that gives emphasis. It's meant to say, he's not just making a statement of fact that Babylon has now come to her conclusion, that she is at her demise. It is a pronouncement of finality. She's fallen. Babylon has fallen. There's a great song. There's a songwriter by the name of Michael Card who writes songs that really come out of Scripture. And he has a CD, and I can't remember what it is, although I can picture it in my mind. I've listened to it so much, I don't know why I don't know the name of it, but it is a CD inspired by the book of Revelation. And there is this powerful song that he has written that plays off of this, and it's fallen. Babylon has fallen. And it's a haunting kind of tune because it's a celebration. This is what's so weird about it. I think he captures what this chapter wants us to see, which is an unlikely celebration of utter devastation. That's what's happening here. The announcement comes. The whole earth is illumined by the presence of this angel. And this is what he says about it. She has become a dwelling for demons, a haunt for every unclean spirit, a haunt for every unclean bird, and a haunt for every unclean and despicable beast. It's a kind of poetic language that basically says that that the devastation of Babylon at the hands of God, at the pouring out of His wrath, is so complete, so utterly devastating, that there is nothing remaining that is good, and there is nothing remaining that is even human. It has been left to the demons as a mark of the utter evilness of this last rebellion against God. One of the things that God does by way of judgment, sometimes God judges by allowing sin to play out in its natural consequences. Well, this city, this empire, this rebellious global system falls at the hands of a wrathful God, but it's left, in a sense, to the natural conclusion of its choices, which is that it is not appropriate for anything except for everything that is considered despicable and evil. I mean, it's hard to even fathom this description. Now here's what's interesting. Verse 3. Why has it come to this? Well, first of all, for all the nations have drunk the wine of her sexual immorality, which brings wrath. The kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality with her, and the merchants of the earth have grown wealthy from her excessive luxury. Two things. It shows this division that I've mentioned, both the political and the economic aspects of this Babylon are seen in this verse, because it mentions the kings of the earth committing sexual immorality. That's a representation of the political element of this system. But then the merchants of the earth, that represents the economic part of this system. Now, what's interesting about this is that the kings are said to have committed sexual immorality. Now, in literal interpretation, I think that we can accept that the angel is saying that the political systems of the world have been degraded and become the structure of animals because of the way sexual immorality has become the highly prized priority on the earth. Folks, when you look at, even in our time, knowing that we're not yet in this system, one of the things that you have to say, and certainly some of you have lived a very long time, one thing that is undeniable is that our obsession with sexual considerations, we've never seen anything like this before. And not only are we obsessed with sex, but we're obsessed with perverted versions of sex. We now live in a day and a time where same gender marriage is legal, and I'm not saying this to just sort of, you know, wring our hands and give up. I'm just illustrating the point. I mean, I'm only 54 years old, but I would never have believed in my lifetime that we would see same-sex marriage, or we would see entire states boycotted by economic interests because they try and pass laws that require men to use men's restrooms and women to use women's restrooms. I mean, you can tell the direction of a society by the laws that they put in place, and I promise you, 50 years ago, nobody ever considered passing a law saying men have to use men's restrooms. I mean, it wasn't a topic. And now it's a thing. The city of Charlotte, North Carolina just passed a law that requires businesses to provide bathroom for biological males, bathroom for biological females, and a separate single bathroom for those who aren't sure. That seems like a very common sense approach to the problem. Only powerful economic interests are now talking about boycotting North Carolina and not allowing conventions and sporting events and things to happen in that state because they say that this is prejudicial against transgendered people. You know, if you told me that I'm so special I could have my own bathroom, I'd think that's a good thing. But see, it's not about equality. It's not about fair play. It's about requiring acceptance and approval of a lifestyle that, honestly, that just flat goes against nature. What is implied here is that we haven't seen anything yet. Because this Babylonian system will find the political leaders of the earth preoccupied with such issues. But there's also a symbolic element, and sexual immorality is often used to speak about spiritual unfaithfulness. And so it can be applied there as well. A political system that refuses to recognize any accountability or acknowledge even the existence of a God before whom we're all required to stand at some point. Now, it's not only the political powers, but the end of that verse says, and the merchants of the earth have grown wealthy from her excessive luxury. Now, this is a great word. The word that's translated here, excessive luxury, is a very rare word in the Greek. It doesn't show up very often. And actually, this is a pretty good translation, but it's a word that means not merely the accumulation of wealth, but it really speaks about the obsession with wealth. What happens in this system is that the merchants of the earth have become excessively devoted to not only gaining and collecting wealth, but displaying it. The earth becomes a place of increasing gaudiness and excessiveness. In fact, I did some research on this word, and the word picture behind this word, it's actually a word that means, oh, man, bless your heart. Where'd that come from? It's like a magic trick. The word is the picture, and this tells you what you need to know. It's the Greek word used to describe an elephant in full trumpet. I mean, it's trunk out, making that sort of sound that echoes across the African savanna that can be heard for miles. It is a statement of meant to impress everybody in sight. That's the word here, excessive luxuries. And so, economically, the earth has become driven not just by the accumulation of wealth, but by the gaudiness of wealth. One of the genres of literature I like are what we call post-apocalyptic literature, but things like The Hunger Games. If you've ever seen any of the Hunger Game movies or read any of the books, there's a culture where the people of the capital city, they've painted their skin all kinds of colors and they've overdone their makeup and their hair is very elaborate and their clothes are just gaudy. I mean, they're just ugly because it's about showing off, even to the point that they have huge banquets where they drink, something like a little ipecac so that they can make themselves throw up so that they can eat more and consume more. Because it is the ultimate in excessive consumption. That's what's being described here. The earth will become that kind of place. Well, here's the warning that goes to God's people, verse 4. John says, then I heard another voice from heaven. Now, it's interesting. Let me just read this. Then I heard another voice from heaven, come out of her, my people. Now, we'll read the rest of this verse, but there's a hint there when this other voice, it's not the voice of the angel that has authority that illuminated the entire earth. This is another voice, but this voice says, come out of her, my people. The implication is John hears the very voice of the one who is seated on the throne. This is God himself at this moment making an announcement to the earth. Come out of her, my people, so that you will not share in her sins or receive any of her plagues. For her sins are piled up to heaven, and God has remembered her crimes. This is the key to the entire passage, I think. God's people, honestly, God's people in every generation, whether we're talking about the Israelites of the Old Testament or the disciples in the New Testament, there is a consistent push all the way through the Bible that says that we're supposed to have compassion toward those who are trapped in their sin. I mean, Jesus came to bring redemption, to offer salvation. We're called to imitate him. Jesus, he extended himself to tax collectors and prostitutes and sinners. But at the same time, while we follow the example of Jesus, there is an acknowledgement throughout Scripture that we do not have the perfected nature that Jesus has. And so there is a kind of holy separation required of us, which means that we're to have a posture toward the world of compassion on them, an attitude of extending the offer of mercy and grace. But we're to be very careful that we don't allow ourselves to become caught up in that lifestyle. I've known people that got into real trouble because they justified participation in evil activity by saying, well, I was just trying to minister. There is a separation all the way through Scripture. The Israelites, sometimes they lost this emphasis and they saw themselves as so separate that they became exclusivistic and prideful. That was not the call of God. But they were called to be different, to be distinctive, to be separate and dedicated to a kind of lifestyle that the surrounding world had to see because it would be winsome and attractive to that world. Well, the implications of this verse, God is telling his people, come out from this system because while we're to be careful not to compromise with secular civilization, but the bottom line here is complicity with Babylon in her sin results in sharing the consequences of her actions. Remember that what we're seeing in chapter 18 is the consequence of the unfolding of the judgments that we saw in chapter 16. God is saying, come out from among them. Be distinct. Don't be marked by them. John, in another place, John is the author of Revelation. In 1 John chapter 2, at another time in his life, he said these words. In John, 1 John 2, beginning in chapter 2, verse 15. He says, do not love the world or the things that belong to the world. If anyone loves the world, love for the Father is not in him. For everything that belongs to the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride in one's lifestyle, is not from the Father, but is from the world. And the world, with its lust, is passing away, but the one who does God's will remains forever. He goes on to say, children, it is the last hour, and as you have heard, Antichrist is coming. Even now, many Antichrists have come. We know from this that it is the last hour. They went out from us, but they did not belong to us, for if they had belonged to us, they would have remained with us. However, they went out so that it might be made clear that none of them belongs to us. John has always had this consistent call that comes from the Spirit that says that we are to to come out from the world and to be distinctive in the way that we live. That's the final warning given here, because what's going to happen is this destruction. I mean, go back to the verses that talk about it's a haunt for demons and a haunt for unclean animals and unclean birds. This destruction is going to be complete. I mean, there's not any remnant of Babylon that's going to be left that can recover, that can reassert itself. Evil is being answered. Now, beginning, go to verse 6, and you're going to see how it's answered. He calls for his people to come out, but then he says this: pay her back the way she also paid, and double it according to her works. In the cup in which she mixed, mix a double portion for her. As much as she glorified herself and lived luxuriously, give her that much torment and grief. For she says in her heart, I sit as a queen, I am not a widow, and I will never see grief. For this reason, her plagues will come in one day, death and grief and famine. She will be burned up with fire, because the Lord God who judges her is mighty. Now here's what's interesting about these verses. Basically, the idea of an eye for an eye, it's misunderstood in our culture today. An eye for an eye is most often used. When I hear somebody on television, you know, somebody's, you know, they interview a family that's going to an execution or something, and they say, well, you know, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Well, you know, that originally in the Old Testament, that standard that God gave to Israel was a remarkable advancement over the cultures that surrounded Israel. Because in the ancient world, the idea wasn't that you paid for a crime with an appropriate payment. The idea in the world was, you punch me, I knock you down. You stab me, I cut off your hand. I mean, the natural human tendency when there is conflict is that it always escalates. I always have to get one worse on you than you did on me, which then requires a retaliation, and it just goes on. There was a judicial step forward when God gave Israel the principle that an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. That is, the punishment must be commensurate with the crime, but never allowed to be excessive. Well, that's been so twisted in our cultural understanding that we think that it's meant to be a justification for me to get my pound of flesh for whatever you've done to hurt me. It's interesting here, though, while that principle was given to sort of regulate human judicial processes, here the judgment is reserved for God. And because God is perfect in his judgment, and because the sins of Babylon are ultimately against God himself, basically what is stated in chapter 18 is that Babylon will receive everything she's done, but in double portion. In a sense, an eye for an eye was a restriction so that I don't hurt you worse than what your crime against me justifies. But what we're talking about here is a global system of rebellion against the one true God that is so outrageously sinful that God is justified to pay back the arrogance of man's rebellion with a double portion of what he has handed out himself. This is an awe-inspiring chapter. Now, pay back the way that she also paid and double it according to her works. In the cup in which she mixed, mix a double portion for her. As much as she glorified herself and lived luxuriously, give her that much torment and grief. And this is why. For she says in her heart, I sit as a queen, I am not a widow, and I will never see grief. In the ancient world, the place of a woman was a very tenuous place in most cultures. In the day that John lived, a woman who had a husband who could provide for her needs and secure protection and provision, That was a life that was to be admired. But when a woman's husband died and she was left widowed, if she didn't have recourse to some sort of a financial nest egg, she was often, to the state of widowhood in the ancient world, was often a position of abject poverty. The New Testament gives the church very specific instructions about this because the expectation is that if a woman is widowed and she's young enough, that she'll eventually marry again. And if she doesn't have family that can help provide for her, the church is given a certain level of expectation of ministry to provide for her need. Now, that's all background to this verse because the global structure that is Babylon will have this implicit attitude that says, I'm like a queen. I have everything. I have need of nothing. I'll never be like a widow and experience grief. From God's perspective, what Babylon, the great city, is saying is, I have finally come to the place where I have the entire world at my disposal and I need nothing. Now, the corollary of I need nothing is I'm indebted to no one, which is also the corollary that comes to I answer to no one. And I'm such a queen that I'll never be in the position of a widow. It's a kind of arrogance that puts God off. I mean, think about this. Every single man, woman, and child on the planet that takes breath is here by special creation of God Himself. Every breath they draw is by the provision of God Himself. Every drop of rain, every day of sunshine, every blessing that we receive comes from God. We are here literally for nothing that we can take credit for. And the end of human history, mankind has come to the place where there is a refusal to acknowledge that God exists in the equation at all. I'm a queen, and I'll never be like a widow. God says, for this reason, her plagues will come in one day. It's fascinating, this idea that this mistress of the world, loved by all the kings who believe they're in control of their own destiny. God said thousands of years of human history are going to culminate in this bright, shining example of the greatest collection of human achievement ever. And because of that, God's going to make it a point to bring it all down in a single day. This really is an awe-inspiring chapter. She will be burned up with fire because the Lord God who judges her is mighty. You see, Babylon at this point will be the master of every kingdom on the planet. There were 10 kings that came together to create the power base for this Antichrist to assume global control. But basically, this global system will be in charge of every national government on the planet. Babylon views herself as an unchallenged queen because there are no kings that she has ever confronted who could withstand her. That's the point of verse 8. She is going to meet the one king left. He's the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. And it will be unlike any other king she has ever encountered. Drop down to verse 20. I want to attach verse 20 to this cry of vengeance, because this is what I was talking about, the call for rejoicing. Verse 20 says, "Rejoice over her, heaven, and you saints, apostles, and prophets, because God has executed your judgment on her." Now, first of all, what's interesting here is that phrase, "rejoice over her," is a command. It is actually in the grammar form that commands. Now, this is not a vindictive cry. This is not God saying, you know, celebrate their misfortune. This is a kind of visceral cheer, celebrating the justice of God. Listen, in that day, there will be two responses to the unfolding wrath. There will be the lament of those who mourn the loss of Babylon, because that's where that person has placed all of their hope. Or there will be a cry, a cheer of celebration. You say, well, you know, I'm not comfortable with the idea that all the saints are going to sit around cheering this destruction. I mean, it's going to be an awful day, the worst day in human history. No, because what we're going to see more unmistakably than at any other time in human history is that we're going to have this unfiltered, unmistakable, clearly defined view of what is true and what is false, what is good, what is evil, what is righteous, and what is unholy. There's not going to be any gray area on this day. And it comes down to this. Either God judges or evil wins. Those are the only two options. So to cheer the destruction of evil is to acknowledge that everything God promised us is true, everything we've hoped for, everything we've yearned for, every instance of injustice that grinds at us, every judicial decision in our lifetime that we knew was not right, everything that happens that just grates on us because we know that it wasn't meant to be this way. On that day, finally, heaven and earth, saints, disciples, prophets, saints, we will look at that and say, God is true. And the command to celebrate will not produce in us some sort of half-hearted obedience. Yay! It's going to be the permission to give what is already welling up inside of us. Because think about it. We've lived our whole lives saying, well, eventually things are going to be made right. Well, evil people don't get away with stuff forever. Well, God doesn't always judge according to my timetable. I mean, we say these kinds of things because there is in us something hardwired in the way we're created that tells us this is not how the world is supposed to be. And this is that day. And I don't think we'll be able to hold back the relief that will spill from us as we finally see everything made right. Man, it's been exhausting to go through these pages and pages and pages of judgment. But at the end, the world will finally be what it was meant to be all along. And if we are the people of God, we will be home. Well, look at the rest of this chapter. Go back up to verse 9. I don't have to spend a lot of time with the last part of this chapter because it's really just an illustration of both the political and the economic side. Let me show you. Verse 9, it talks about the political side of this Babylon. The kings of the earth who have committed sexual immorality and lived luxuriously with her will weep and mourn over her when they see the smoke of her burning. You see, that's one of the two options, one of the two responses. There will be grievous mourning because all of their hopes have been tied to this Babylon. Verse 10, they will stand far off in fear of her torment, saying, "Woe, woe the great city, Babylon the mighty city, for in a single hour your judgment has come." I mean, these are the arrogant political leaders that have dominated the earth and then given their power into the hands of the Antichrist, who will become a single global dictator. Now, why would they do that? Why does any political head of state give authority to a dictator? Because he hopes to finagle a position in the new regime. That's what they've done. They've taken the God-given responsibility that a political leader has for the care of the people under his charge. You see, government is a delegated responsibility from God. And even dictators, especially dictators, have to answer for the way they care for their people. They've handed willingly their authority into the hands of one who will rule the whole earth. And they did so because they were ambitious. And they wanted to be in the in crowd, among the power brokers. And now they stand at a distance and weep because every dream, every ambition, every hope for power, for wealth, for control is gone. And it was gone in a single hour. That's the political leaders. Now look at the economic side of this. Verse 11, the merchants of the earth will also weep and mourn over her, because no one buys their merchandise any longer. I mean, think about this. A city that has been bombed out of existence by the wrath of God is not a place where there's a lot of economic activity going on. It's now haunted by demons and animals and birds. But listen to this description. 29, I think I've counted. I think there's 29 categories here. No one buys their merchandise any longer. Merchandise of gold, silver, precious stones and pearls, fine fabrics of linen, purple, silk and scarlet, all kinds of fragrant wood products, objects of ivory, objects of expensive wood, brass, iron and marble, cinnamon, spice, incense, myrrh and frankincense, wine, olive oil, fine wheat flour and grain, cattle and sheep, horses and carriages, oh, and slaves and human lives. What he's describing here is every kind of category of expensive and elaborate expressions of wealth. But you get to the end and you see the real heart of the matter. In the last days, one of the signs of economic power will be that the wealthy will be those who traffic in slaves and human lives. The fruit you craved has left you. All your splendid and glamorous things are gone. They will never find them again. The merchants of these things who become rich from her will stand far off in fear of her torment, weeping and mourning, saying, "Woe, woe the great city, dressed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, adorned with gold, precious stones and pearls, for in a single hour such fabulous wealth was destroyed. Every example of extravagant consumption and the economic power brokers of the day testify to the same thing that the political power brokers say. It all came crashing down in a single hour. It's gone. We had accumulated much wealth, but not only accumulated, but we had displayed it. Even the lives of slaves and other humans. Well, what's the connection between the political and the economic branches? It is the transportation industries that take the economic product from around the world and with political approval have passage to the marketplaces around the globe. So this last remnant of the structure is now mentioned in verse 17. It says, "And every shipmaster, seafarer, the sailors, and all who do business by sea," that is, those who work for the economic power brokers and transport wealth at the permission of the political power brokers, these are the guys that get things from place to place. "They also stood far off as they watched the smoke from her burning and kept crying out, 'Who is like the great city?' They threw dust on their heads and kept crying out, weeping and mourning, 'Woe, woe, the great city, where all those who have ships on the sea became rich from her wealth. For in a single hour she was destroyed.'" We're back to verse 20. "Rejoice over her, heaven, and you saints, apostles, and prophets, because God has executed your judgment on her." That's an interesting phrase I didn't point out the first time we read that verse. God has executed your judgment. You see, this is the judgment of God. But the testimony of heaven and of the saints and of the prophets of every generation, from the perspective that we will have on that day, we will stand as witnesses that this judgment is just. God says that I will execute your judgment. We, in a sense, God is the judge. We, in a sense, are the jury. And we will speak affirmatively that this action of God is, in fact, proper and just and right. And God will execute it. Well, verse 21, the finality of all of this. I want to get to these verses. It says, "Then a mighty angel picked up a stone like a large millstone and threw it into the sea, saying..." Now, this is another part of the vision that John sees. He sees an angel take a millstone. Now, you know what a millstone is. A millstone can be of various sizes. You can have a handheld millstone that you use kind of in a, what's it called, a pestle? And it can go all the way to the millstones that turn and grind that are huge. He sees a mighty angel. Now, I don't know if it's the same angel that was in verse 1. It doesn't say, but that description of mighty angel would fit the one who spoke with authority and illuminated the whole earth with his glory. "This mighty angel picked up a stone like a large millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, 'In this way, Babylon, the great city, will be thrown down violently and never be found again. The sound of harpists, musicians, flutists, and trumpeters will never be heard in you again. No craftsman of any trade will ever be found in you again. The sound of a mill will never be heard in you again. The light of a lamp will never shine in you again. The voice of a groom and bride will never be heard in you again. All this will happen because your merchants were the nobility of the earth, because all the nations were deceived by your sorcery." Now, we're going to stop there before the last verse because I want to talk about this for a minute. The image is of an angel who takes this massive millstone and throws it into the sea. Now, use your imagination to picture what John is seeing. There are two aspects of this, and they've said that this is a picture of the destruction of Babylon. First, a millstone of massive size that was cast into the ocean, one thing that it would do is it would cause a huge splash. I mean, it's not going to slip away quietly into the deep. It's going to make a tidal wave kind of effect. In other words, the destruction of this city, Babylon, it's not going to go out with a whimper. I mean, this is going to be a spectacular moment of destruction. But in the moment that that millstone lands in the ocean and makes this tidal wave, this tsunami kind of effect, in the very next minute, what happens? Sinks straight to the bottom. Never to be seen, never to be found, never to be recovered again. That's the other part of what it's saying about the destruction of Babylon. It will be dramatic. It will be impressive. But in the end, Babylon will be gone. And it goes through this almost poetic description. There'll never be music heard there again. There'll never be anything sold there again. There'll never be anything produced there again. In fact, it says there'll never even be the normal affairs of everyday life. You won't even see or hear the sounds of a bride and groom coming together. It uses the image of a wedding as sort of the normal process of human life. As long as humans have been, I mean, from the Garden of Eden forward, the most basic activity of human life has been marrying and having children. Nothing of normal human existence will ever happen there again. I mean, again, I hope I'm not overstating. What an awe-inspiring description this chapter is. Now, the bottom line question is this. Why? I mean, we know that they stand in arrogant opposition to God. But I mean, God goes out of His way to eliminate every last remnant of this city, this final version of godless human culture. Well, it's in the final chapter, the final verse of the chapter, verse 24. It says in verse 23, all this will happen first because your prophets were your merchants were the nobility of the earth, because all the nations were deceived by your sorcery. But here's the bottom line. And the blood of prophets and saints and all those slaughtered on earth was found in you. Here's the bottom line. Because of man's rebellion against God, God is perfectly justified to wipe mankind off the face of the earth, to eliminate him forever and ever, to separate them from himself in a place of punishment and isolation for all of eternity. He is perfectly justified because of the way mankind has offended God. But it's interesting that when it comes right down to it, God doesn't say, I have done this thing because of their rebellion against me. He says, I have paid them what they deserve because the blood of my children was found in their midst. You see, the crime beyond the execution of the only begotten Son of God, the crime above all other crimes in human history, is that the world hated those that God loved. And the world gave itself to an enemy who was determined to lash out at God. There's one principle that's been true in every generation of human history, and it is this. There's just almost nothing you can do to me personally that would hurt me more than if you did it to my children. If you're a parent, you know how this works. You would take any beating You would take any abuse. You would take any punishment if they would just leave your children alone. The devil has known from day one that he couldn't unseat the one who sits on the throne. So his strategy has always been to take those whom God loves and do his dead level best to kill, steal, and destroy their lives. And in the last day, the judgment of God falls on a rebellious planet, and God says, what you've done to my children, it's enough. And it will never be done again. Not one more. I don't know how many remain to be martyred before that day comes. I know that there have been more martyrs for the Christian faith in the last 100 years than in the 2,000 years before that. In a sense, the hostility and the attack globally toward the people of God is accelerating. That's not paranoia. That's not victim consciousness on my part. That's just statistics. I don't know how long it lasts. I don't know how long it continues. But I do know that I was so deeply moved when I read Randy Alcorn's book, Safely Home, one of the greatest novels ever written, I think. And there's a scene in which heaven is watching the persecution in this particular episode of persecution of a pastor in China. And the one who sits on the throne reaches down, and with his fingers, he fingers the handle of his sword. And all of heaven tenses and wonders, is it now? Is this the moment? And they watch the fingers touch the handle of the sword and then withdraw. And there's a deep breath in heaven. They know what's coming, but it's not yet. But it is as certain and as sure as the promises of God have always been. One day, it is fallen. Babylon is fallen. And our brothers and sisters will be avenged. Man, I can't wait to get to chapter 19 because we're going to celebrate victory. Father, thank you for your word. It is powerful to us. It is meaningful to us. Lord, it strengthens our soul. Thank you for your word. Thank you for teaching us by your Spirit, making it plain to us, so that we can walk with confidence through our generation. Father, protect and guide and bless the people who are called Evergreen, so that we might be found busy and faithful at our task when you come for your people. Lord, thank you for the assurances of victory, for the promises of justice. Father, thank you for your grace and mercy to us. Pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.